Trump as a brand we all know about by now. What about Trump as a builder, though? Some macroeconomics and some good news on homelessness as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, it is the 17th day of May. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. Another day, another economic indicator, one that we have on this very radio program declared dead on more than one occasion. Regular listeners will know that I'm talking here about inflation, something called the Consumer Price Index, which the Labor Department told us this morning went up last month by a completely underwhelming 0.4%. Now, yes, that was the biggest month-over-month increase in 3 years, but the devil, as it so often is with these indicators, is in the details. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has them.
The first thing to note, asterisk number one, is that a big-sounding increase, it's relative. Inflation is still low, says Zachary Carabel. He's head of global strategies at Envestnet, a financial services firm.
The problem of things being incredibly low is that any change, however minimal, will look big. If you have a dollar and you suddenly get $2, you can say statistically that your money has increased by 100%.
Michelle Girard, chief U.S. economist at RBS, says thanks to the strong dollar, cheap imports, prices for some goods even decreased.
Both new and used car prices were weak, and apparel prices were weak.
But on the other hand, in services,
we saw increases in rent and airfares and other services like education and recreation.
And the really, really big factor driving that headline 0.4% increase last month, energy prices. Gas up 8%. Ann Owen is econ professor at Hamilton College.
When you look at the trend of energy prices in the last few months, they are increasing. But still, they're less than they were a year ago.
There's asterisk two. Energy prices are boosting inflation in the short term, but not in the longer view. And asterisk number three is that lots of economists and policymakers will ignore energy prices when looking at inflation because they just fluctuate too much. The data's too noisy. And that makes the inflation number they're looking at even lower. Seeing stars, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You know how every now and then after a piece, I tell you where you can find all of our stories and then how you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter? That's engagement of a sort, us trying to connect with you. Not that that's a big secret nowadays, but a word here about the actual content of one's tweets. Bloomberg is reporting that Twitter is going to stop counting photos and links in its oh-so-restrictive 140-character limit. And I know you don't have to say it. It sounds trivial, but trust me, in the worlds of social media and social media marketing and mobile life writ large today, oh, it's a big deal. Marketplace's Andy Euler says so.
It's totally a big deal. I mean, now I get to show you a picture of that super dope breakfast taco I just ordered, and I get to send you a link to the restaurant's Yelp page, and I still have 140 characters to feed you a snarky joke about it being the most important meal of the day. This is a game changer.
I mean, this is all stuff that really caters to marketers, to be honest.
That's Jenny Sussin. She's a researcher at Gartner. She says the move isn't for you and me. It's for
people who don't really like the paradigm of Twitter but want access to the audience of Twitter.
The thing that makes Twitter, Twitter, was actually the result of limited technology. 140 characters was more or less the limit of a text message. Now we all have smartphones and don't pay for individual texts, so the character limit is obsolete. At 10 years old, Twitter is already a legacy company, and its legacy has limited it to being a platform used by first adopters, celebrities, marketers, and, well, journalists. Julie Osk is an analyst at Forrester.
And it just hasn't been able to become something that the general population, where my mother and my dad and my grandmother want to use it as a platform to get news and information. And they're struggling as a result.
To catch up, Twitter basically has to reinvent itself, one of the hardest things to do in the business world. And if it succeeds, by letting you send pictures, stream live sporting events, and catch up on the latest Kardashian news in one click, Google and Facebook are already there. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here is today's Marketplace quiz. It's a two-parter, so get ready. Number one, what happened today in 1792? Here's a hint. Has to do with the New York Stock Exchange. Anybody? Not good enough of a hint? All right. Okay. 17th of May, 1792, under a buttonwood tree in front of number 68 Wall Street, 24 brokers signed what has come to be called the Buttonwood Agreement, thereby starting the New York Stock Exchange. So, which gets me to part two, what was traded that day? You're never going to get this one, so I'll just tell you. U.S. Treasury bonds, three slices of those. Also shares in the Bank of New York and the Bank of the United States. No idea where prices closed that day, but on this Tuesday by rights, it should be the Wawa trombones. As we all know, though, I don't get to decide. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Chances are pretty good, better than pretty good actually, that you've got an HP printer somewhere in your office. Hewlett-Packard has been making them and making money off them for decades. But inkjet, I will tell you, is so passe. HP Ink, which is the printer and PC part of the original HP that split in two last year, announced a big 3D printing initiative today, banking on its appeal to American manufacturers. Dion Weisler is the CEO of HP Ink. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Is it fair to say that you're kind of betting the future of this company on 3D printing?
Well, look, we're really excited about the work we're doing across our core products, products that we have in our growth engines, but we're incredibly excited about the categories that we're creating, and 3D printing is an incredible part of that.
So is that a yes or a no?
It's part of a complement of an entire suite of products, but we think it has the opportunity to tap into a $12 trillion manufacturing industry, and that's pretty exciting.
Seems to me what we're really talking about here is a productivity tool, right? You want manufacturing to be more agile and quicker. So help me understand how, I don't know, like Nike or BMW would use this.
Well, we think it does more than that. We think it actually democratizes manufacturing. Manufacturing today typically happens in faraway places, and that costs a lot of inventory, warehousing costs, costs of capital are all tied up. And this enables you to move manufacturing much closer to where your customers are. And so companies like Nike, like BMW, like Johnson & Johnson are working with us as close technology partners and figuring out how they can build innovative products where complexity is essentially free, this high innovation curve, and bring breakthrough products to market.
Complexity is free. It also sounds like that means failure is without cost, without risk. You can just keep banging stuff out.
Well, you can certainly prototype, and 3D printing's been prototyping for many years now. I guess what we're doing differently here is we've also launched a range of low production run printers as well. So that enables you to do those low production runs that extend beyond traditional prototyping.
Low production runs, meaning some guy in his garage trying to tinker with stuff?
Well, think about our business. Think about our 3D printing business. Today, it's not a very high volume business. And in fact, 50% of the parts inside our printer are printed by our printer. So that's kind of pretty cool. And it's perfect for those kind of production runs. As it builds scale and you're doing millions, you'll use traditional manufacturing. But for short production runs, this makes much more economic sense.
The other half of your business, the other half of your portfolio is PCs, of course. And I wonder whether or not you're going to orphan those things as this slice of it gets better because PC sales are, as we've seen, plummeting.
Well, both PCs and printing are mature categories, but they're still $415 billion market. I don't think PCs ever go away. People are still going to have to interact with their digital worlds. But we're going to create new categories, immersive computing, different ways in which you interact with your PCs, take things from the physical world, bring them into the digital world, change them, manipulate them, and then with 3D printing, take them back out to the physical world.
Let me try something with you that I tried with Ms. Whitman when I had her on the program about 4 or 5 years ago, back when HP was just one company. Do me a favor and describe your company in 5 words or less.
We are that's a great question.
I know, and I will tell you that Ms. Whitman had a tough time. So
okay, well, let me do it in three. Engineering experiences that amaze.
That's four, but okay, we'll give it to you. We'll give it to you. Dion Weisler, he's the CEO of HP Inc. Mr. Weisler, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai, great to be here. Thanks.
We We've done a series of stories the past couple of months about homelessness in Los Angeles County, about the sharp rise in homelessness here, to be specific. Today, a not small bright spot. In the most recent census of homeless people in Los Angeles County, the number of veterans living on the streets fell 44%. Jeff Tyler, our reporter on the series, explains how that happened.
69-year-old Larry Daniels was forced onto the streets through no fault of his own.
We was living in Long Beach, me and my wife, and we were evicted illegally.
We had never been homeless. Never.
That's Larry's wife, Jacqueline. They ended up living in a shelter on Skid Row.
I was never so glad to get from down there.
Why? What was so bad about it?
Honey, the drugs. Them poor people living on the street, shooting heroin right there. It's a horrible scene.
Last September, they moved into this one-bedroom apartment in a brand-new building.
Everybody, when they come, they say, oh, this is just beautiful. And I'd be like, I know. I'm just grateful that we were chosen.
They were chosen because Larry is a veteran. In fact, the whole building is occupied by vets. And they all have a dedicated case manager who helps with financial issues. For example, Larry is in a dispute with an auto loan company.
They repossessed my car, mistakenly. But they wanted to give the car back and want me to refinance. So I told them to take the car and shove it.
Instead, a settlement was reached. Larry's case manager, Michael Edwards, is helping them to collect the money that they're owed.
We still haven't recovered the money that they was promised.
And how much money are we talking about?
$5,000.
Some of the other vets need more than just financial help. Edwards says some of the residents still act like they're homeless.
Some of them been on the streets for quite some time, and it's hard to get out of that behavior. But if they got somebody monitoring their behavior, trying to help them change their attitude, then that's what we're here for, and to keep them housed.
Vets like Larry Daniels are getting moved off the streets faster because the VA is adopting a model known as Housing First. Heidi Marston is a special assistant to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
It's the whole idea of taking a veteran, connecting with them, putting a roof over their head first, and then surrounding them with all the services that they need to be successful. Because it really starts with having a bed to sleep in at night and a place where you feel safe that's your own.
The VA is partnering with HUD to get veterans housed and supported with case managers. Between them, the two departments are spending around $20,000 per vet. Vince Kane with the VA says the program is less expensive than leaving a homeless veteran on the streets.
When you have them in housing, use of ERs, use of medical services, unnecessary inpatient hospitalizations, whether it's for medical care or for psychiatric care, incarceration, all those things go down.
One of the pioneers of Housing First is Sam Simbaris, founder and CEO of Pathways to Housing National. He's seen success with the model in cities across the country. Now he's helping the VA and says its collaboration with HUD is particularly effective.
The HUD VA program, I would say, is the singular most effective example in the United States where you have two federal agencies for the first time collaborating on a really important social issue and actually putting in the millions and millions of dollars that it takes.
The VA and HUD are spending around $116 million a year on the program in Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles is embracing a similar strategy. LA plans to put the bulk of its resources behind the Housing First model in its own efforts to combat homelessness. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He put up a string of apartment towers that literally block the sun from the entire Upper West Side of Manhattan.
I'll give you one guess, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. How do I not get the wah-wah trombones? The Dow Industrial is off 180 points, 1%, 17,529. The NASDAQ off 59 points, 1.25%. I give up. Finished at 47.15. The S&P 500 down 19 points, 9/10%, 2,047. We told you about Twitter's move beyond the 140-character universe. Company's stock rode up 0.3%. Facebook down 1.1% today. Rising gas prices drove much of the uptick in the consumer price index that Tracy Samuelson was talking about. But energy companies did stall a bit today. BP and ExxonMobil both moved less than 0.1%. Chevron sputtered down 0.4%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.76%. I can't even believe it. Balalaikas, for crying out loud. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In front of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee today, House Resolution 24, the Federal Reserve Transparency Act of 2015, a bill, quote, to require a full audit of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve Banks of the United States. You may know it by its more simple political shorthand, the Audit the Fed bill, an idea made famous by, among others, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. The desire to audit the Fed, though, to increase the accountability of what can at times be an opaque government agency, comes with various degrees of desired transparency. One of those takes comes from Andrew Levin. He's a professor of economics at Dartmouth College and before that a Fed staffer for many years. Professor, good to speak with you.
Great. Nice to be with you.
We should say right off the bat, this is not an audit the Fed proposal as we have come to know it, right?
Right. So I think a critical distinction here, and the reason I would not support the audit the Fed proposals that have been made in the past, is that the Federal Reserve's ability to make an independent judgment on specific monetary policy decisions is very important. It should not be subject to any kind of political interference. So what I'm proposing here is a regular annual review. I can see, you know, where there are dangers of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and that those need to be avoided. But on the other hand, there is room for improvement. Not surprising after 100 years that there are some significant ways to improve the Federal Reserve's governance and transparency and accountability to the public.
Just to be clear here, the Fed is – its financial operations, its balance sheet and its transactions, they are audited on a regular basis, right?
Well, it's there's an important distinction we should make. The Federal Reserve currently has a private organization to a standard – audit of its financial sheets every year. That's purely intended to detect any evidence of fraud or mismanagement. That's not intended to try to see is there anywhere that the Federal Reserve could be more effective in promoting the interests of the public or protecting the taxpayers.
Talk to me for a minute about the regional Federal Reserve banks, the ones in New York and Chicago and Philadelphia, all of those. You want more transparency about who is on the boards of the regional feds, about how they choose their presidents. Explain to me why that is important.
The problem right now at the Federal Reserve is that there has never, ever in 100 years been a single African-American serving as president of a regional Fed. There are 12 banks, 12 regional Fed banks, 100 years. You can call it 1,200 years of tenure. And not a single one of those 1,200 years of tenure has been served by an African American. So there's clearly a problem here. And the proposal that I've made is to change the process to make it more transparent and to ensure that the directors and the Reserve Bank presidents represent the broader American public.
Do you think people would be surprised to find out that the regional feds, there are ownership stakes held in the regional feds by the big commercial banks, and the big commercial banks have representation on the boards of the regional feds?
Well, people I've spoken with are generally surprised. There's no conspiracy here. It's just, as I say, traces back to the founding of the Fed 100 years ago, the fact that that's the way the organization works. But again, 100 years later, I think it makes very good sense to make a relatively modest change to the Federal Reserve. You preserve the regional structure. You preserve the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, but just make them fully public and fully accountable to the public.
Andrew Levin worked for many years at the Federal Reserve. He is now a professor of economics at Dartmouth College. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Great. Thanks a lot. Good talking to you.
It's going to be be years, maybe a lot of years, before political scientists and historians fully unpack Donald Trump's impact on the American political landscape. It's somewhat easier to evaluate his impact on the actual landscape. Mr. Trump is, as he often reminds us, a businessman, specifically a businessman who got his start as a real estate developer. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore took a look at Trump's architectural legacy.
Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue is angular, black and gold, glass all around, and you walk in and...
I see waterfalls, granite, a lot of his name everywhere.
Lauren Katz gets her coffee at the Starbucks here.
Definitely a lot of gold. The escalators are gold. It's gold in the lobby. His bar has gold. Gold all around. I mean, it's aesthetically pleasing.
He believes in using expensive materials that convey prestige and wealth, and people buy into that.
Gerald Kaden is professor of urban planning and design at Harvard. He says in some ways, the legacy of Trump buildings is a matter of taste.
To some, they're the height of ambition and the height of prestige, and to others, they're gaudy. But he has certainly pioneered, with some others, architecture as brand.
Brand it is. Trump's name is on at least 9 buildings in New York alone, though he doesn't own all of them.
Glitz and ego.
Blair Kamen is the architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune.
He doesn't do a lot of affordable housing.
Kamen actually became a target of Trump's after he criticized the decision to put a giant sign on Chicago's Trump Tower.
The sign consisted of his name in stainless steel letters, glowing at night, and it was half as long as a football field, and the letters were 20 feet high. And the sign was in a particularly annoying place.
The city council there passed an ordinance to keep this sort of thing from happening in the future, but the original giant Trump letters are still hanging right up there.
This was started by a third-rate architectural critic for the Chicago Tribune, who I thought got fired. He was gone for a long period of time.
That was Trump speaking on the Today Show. Kamen actually has a Pulitzer and was on a fellowship at Harvard anyway.
His legacy ranges from buildings that have actually been praised.
Like Trump World Tower. It's this narrow obsidian slab of a building across from the UN. It had the first inertial damper in a residential building to control swaying.
To buildings that have been panned.
He put up a string of apartment towers that literally block the sun from the entire Upper West Side of Manhattan.
John Stewart there. The buildings cast some shadows, like all buildings do, but they also went up over a former rail yard. They represented investment in luxury building at a time in the 90s when New York was struggling with blight. Some New Yorkers credit him for making parts of their city shine.
One aspect that I think is generally unrecognized is his sensitivity to designing the buildings from the inside out.
Jesse Keenan is research director at the Center for Urban Real Estate at Columbia. Trump builds for the rich, and the rich want personal urban spaces to feel luxurious. So balconies were placed for views, floor plans were opened up, extra corners were added for more corner offices. The outside came second, other than often having a giant Trump sign, of course.
So in many ways, you're designing the building for the end user, which is a very different proposition from designing a superficial form that is in the mind of the architect, and then you squeeze units in.
So there are a lot of words you can use to describe Trump's architectural legacy. Modernist, ostentatious, branded, and, like the man, complicated. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Finally today on The Way Out, the company newsletter, that time-honored in-house publication where you can read about changes to the dental plan or find out what Betsy in sales did on Volunteer Day. Turns out the National Security Agency is no different. SID today, the Signals Intelligence Directorate, that is. That newsletter first appeared in March of 2003. The Intercept, the website that first published the Edward Snowden leaks, got its hands on the archive, a rare window into a secretive community that kind of makes you say, hey, look, spies. They're just like us. Stuff like promoting the company's 5-year plan.
April 2nd, 2003. Please take the time to read the SIGINT Enterprise Strategy. It's not what the strategy says so much as what it causes to happen in the hands of brilliant people.
Also, how to handle the mail.
April 8th, 2003. Does this package get the express treatment or the scenic route?
Much of the registry's work is invisible to the general SID workforce, but if the system runs smoothly and there are no derailments, we've done our job.
And how to unwind on a company business trip.
December 22, 2003. An early start can have you climbing John Paul Jones Hill to the Joint Task Force skiff while taking in a beautiful sunrise over the Caribbean Sea with Camp Delta looming austerely below on the southern coastline.
Camp Delta. Guantanamo. So, yeah, maybe not like every other company newsletter, huh? Hi, Kai Rizdal here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. Mandolins, balalaikas, I don't know what they were, but they weren't the trombones. The Dow off 180 points today, 1%. The NASDAQ down 59 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 lost 19 points, 0.9%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kurwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.